Hi there, I'm Patrick McEnroe, and it's great to have you with us for another Tennis Worthy podcast, brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. Our theme for this month is tradition, but in this show, we're going to look at how the four most traditional tournaments in tennis, the four majors, or Grand Slams as they are more commonly known, have had to keep up with the times, while at the same time safeguarding the traditions that have given them their identity. The four tournaments represent the economically powerful countries where tennis first took hold. But why did the Australian and US Opens move to new purpose-built venues? Or perhaps the question should be, why did Wimbledon and Roland Garros stay where they were? And why is Wimbledon still a private members club when that model was abandoned by the US and Australian tennis associations? Chris Bowers reports.
The four majors make up a set of highly contrasting tournaments that each reflect their city and country. Wimbledon is the oldest, dating from 1877, while Roland Garros wasn't open to international competitors until 1925. The first major of the year, the Australian Open, dates from 1905, when it was founded as the Australasian Championships. In its early years, it was twice played in New Zealand, and it then moved between five Australian cities. When tennis went open in 1968, it was the Australian Open which struggled most to keep its Grand Slam status. Perth had already dropped out, Adelaide and Brisbane proved too small in the late 60s for a growing sport, so the only two venues that could stage the Open were White City in Sydney and the Kooyong Club on the outskirts of Melbourne. In 1972, Kooyong won the battle to become the sole venue and regular home of the Australian Open. Steve Wood was an Australian player in the 1980s who went on to be chief executive of Tennis Australia and is now president of the Kooyong Club.
One of the reasons that it rotated around was to share the Australian Open asset to each of the states of Australia in a federated business model. It kept growing and getting bigger, and it ended up in White City and Kooyong, and then settled on Kooyong as the only place that could host it. And lo and behold, in 10 years after that, it needed to move again. And the growth was such that we needed to have a purpose-built facility and government assistance to make that happen.
Was that because tennis was just growing so fast that any tournament had to expand? Or was it that Australian tennis underestimated what was necessary to host a Grand Slam?
I think it was a combination of growth of tennis at that time and also the capability of a private club, which is what Kooyong is, to host an event of the magnitude of the Australian Open Grand Slam wasn't there. And so the capability to be able to host the Australian Open came into question.
It wasn't just Kooyong's capability that came into question, its willingness was an issue too. As the most prestigious tennis venue in Australia's premier sporting city, the Kooyong Club hosted numerous tournaments and was also the home of tennis development activities in the state of Victoria, of which Melbourne is the capital city. Peter Johnston was another Australian player in the 1980s who went on to become a tournament promoter. He experienced the tensions at Kooyong at first hand.
In the early 80s, there was a big move where Kooyong was the headquarters of Victorian tennis, but it was also a club which had 4,000 members. And so there was always that age-old battle of what use do the members get and what use does the federation get in terms of who gets the courts. And, you know, the locker room's busy with suddenly there's the national junior titles on and then there's the Australian Open every year and hang on, I want my court for my Sunday morning members. So that led to actually a little revolution back in the early 80s, which then meant that the headquarters of what was then the Lawn Tennis Association of Victoria had to find new offices in a sense and actually a new venue to train players for player development. Because I remember in the late 70s, we'd have the national or the state training squads, and we'd have the Sunday morning. I remember the squad at 8 a.m. it'd start Sunday morning, so we'd train early. But then suddenly the members had come by about 8:20 or so and put their rackets at the back of the court, which was their way of staking out the court for as soon as the training was done. So there was always a lot of this tension, and it's not uncommon to have they're two competing forces.
It's like the towels on the sun lounger.
It is exactly that, Chris. And so anyway, there was that move, which then led to the State Federation needing to find a home. And there was a council called Camberwell Council, which was a little bit away from Kooyong. The council did a deal with the State Association to create a 28-court complex. We're now mid-80s. And so that became the new headquarters of Victorian Tennis. Kooyong became a club, solely a club, versus being the joint situation, and was sort of considered the bad character now because they were so, because Kooyong was a high demographic area where it's turned into an elite club versus looking after tennis as a whole. Kooyong as a club, it wasn't such a huge move because it wasn't running the Australian Open, so it was really just, it was reverting to just only servicing one group, if you like, which was the members, rather than trying to help facilitate tennis in Victoria.
Yet the tensions went beyond just whether the private members club at Kooyong wanted to host the Australian Open. The tournament was definitely the poor relation among the four majors. A number of players didn't travel to Australia in the 70s and early 80s, and for a few years the women were in a different week to the men. Most obviously, the economics of the Australian Open meant it had a title sponsor from the mid-70s and a tobacco company at that. So the tennis authorities needed to get the players back, and yet the only venue big enough to host the Australian Open was becoming ever more reluctant. In addition, the local economy was in a mess and the state government was in Labour hands. Yet, when Tennis Australia's president, Brian Tobin, put forward the idea of a publicly funded new facility with retractable roof in the centre of Melbourne, it found fertile ground. Steve Wood again.
The foresight for that was put forward by the administrators at the time, right back with Brian Tobin, Jeff Pollard. The tennis industry at that time lobbied the government heavily to make this pitch to them to invest. John Cain saw that foresight in the middle of one of the worst downturns in economic times for the Victorian economy. He still made the investment in what we now know as Rod Laver Arena, and that proved to be the masterstroke that got the Australian Open up and running.
Note the name John Cain there. He was the state premier of Victoria, and his name now adorns one of the three stadiums at Melbourne Park that have a retractable roof. That was because he was willing to commit public money to create a new multi-purpose home for the Australian Open, a politically risky decision, as Peter Johnston recalls.
There's the pressure on Kooyong as a venue because it was the only place, it was the right home for the Australian Open, the right facility, the right number of courts, etc., but it was, if it ever wanted to keep up with the other slams and, you know, keep growing, well, the prize money was so small. And then there was very fruitful discussions with Brian Tobin, with the Victorian government, which was John Cain. That was like, how do we find a way to grow the Australian Open with the government support? Because also, this is the other thing, you needed government support then, because Kooyong had no appetite as a club to fund upgrades to the stadium. So then you're looking at the situation of the government having land, because they're the government, but it was very close to the CBD of Melbourne, but that was fraught with controversy because it was parkland. And so if you're going to take parkland, you better be careful. But there was some bravery shown by the government. But the condition was, at the time, that the facilities had to be multi-purpose. You couldn't build a standalone tennis centre that close to the CBD without it being something for the community all year round. And that's why Rod Laver Arena became multi-purpose and why it had the roof. And then it was very much a collaborative effort, which it still is today. You know, all the changes to what we see at Melbourne Park are all government-funded. And when the 56 Olympics had been held, part of it across the road from Melbourne Park, which is now used for it was used for hospitality, but it's the it's a football training ground. There's soccer played there, so there was a precedent that this land had some use for sport, and the Australian Open was in favour in with the public. You know, it was a significant event even at that time. So the deal was done, create a multi-purpose facility here, governed by a trust, and there was collaboration to build what was required to host a Grand Slam, but it's still to this day, it's a trust of which Tennis Australia is actually a tenant here.
Part of the condition for the venue to be multi-purpose was to have a surface that could be used all year round, and that condemned grass to the Australian Open history books. The tournament came close to choosing artificial grass, but settled on a rubberised hard court called Rebound Ace that was made from recycled tyres. The last grass court Aussie Open was played at Kooyong in January 1987, with the first at the new venue, at the time called Flinders Park, taking place a year later. And the gamble paid off instantly. 140,000 people had come through the gates of Kooyong in 87, almost double that. 266,436 came through the gates of the new venue in 88, and that number broke through the million barrier in 2025. A true sign of progression flying in the face of tradition. If the Australian Open was struggling in the 1970s, things weren't running smoothly for the French either. But just as Brian Tobin had found a way of going against the political grain in Australia, the French tennis community had a figure equally or more visionary than Tobin in Philippe Chatrier. In fact, the modernisation of Roland Garros, the correct name for the tournament more widely known by its nickname, the French Open, was down to Chatrier's project to bring French tennis into the modern era. But who was Philippe Chatrier? A question for the tennis historian, one-time Paris resident, and now Hall of Famer, Richard Evans.
Philippe Chatrier was a dreamer, a visionary, and an activist, and also a tennis player, and you don't find many of them. He was very much an introvert in many ways. You would find him sitting in corners. One night when we'd been out to dinner, he didn't come up to his apartment on the Avenue d'Etienne. He sat in his car for half an hour and thought, and then rejoined us. And he was a man of many moods. He was obviously quite a good tennis player, good enough to get on the fringe of the French Davis Cup, third round here, third round at Wimbledon. But that wasn't his forte. His forte was organising and visioning the future of the game. And he had endless ideas. He was an extraordinary personality.
Unlike the other three majors, which were still in private clubs as open tennis dawned, the French had had their own state-assisted facility for 40 years. When the legendary quartet of French tennis players, known as the Musketeers, won the Davis Cup in 1927, they earned France the right to stage the 1928 Davis Cup final, and the city of Paris cooperated with the French tennis authorities to build a clay court tennis venue on the western edge of Paris. A condition of city support was that the new venue had to carry the name of Roland Garros, an aviator who died in the last weeks of the First World War. By 1968, the venue still hosted the world's most prestigious clay court tournament, but Chatrier could see it was losing ground in the rapidly modernising world of professional tennis. Richard Evans spoke to me in the main stadium at Roland Garros that today carries Chatrier's name, and I asked him what Chatrier did to modernise his flagship tournament.
Went to the French government and asked for $14 million
and got it.
When you came into the complex, when I first came here in 1961, it ended at the Allée Suzanne Longlin, which meant that everything to the west of the Chatrier Stadium were rugby fields. And so he took over all that. He asked the French government to buy that, essentially, and expanded this complex by probably a third or more.
And yet in 1974, an awful lot of the top players didn't play the French Open for 6 years because there was world team tennis. So clearly the spirit of the times were, well, we'll play Wimbledon, but the other three majors aren't that important.
Yeah, there was a feeling of that. I mean, big money, and WTT represented big money, was so new and unusual, it was almost irresistible because the players had been earning nothing virtually. And when something came along that gave them fat checks, many of them simply weren't in the position to say no.
So was Chatrier then fighting for one of the old properties? You know, the four majors were the old properties in tennis. Was he not fighting against the tide?
Well, no, he wasn't fighting against the tide because I don't think anybody really expected world team tennis to replace Roland Garros. And it certainly wasn't going to happen once Philippe got hold of it and started modernising the place and selling tickets and flying to Johannesburg to ask Owen Williams what he was doing creating sponsors' boxes. What a thought. Nobody thought of a sponsors' box until Owen Williams did it at the South African Open. And Philippe and the chairman of the All England Club both flew to Johannesburg to find out what he was doing and came back here and did it. Philippe was prepared to take ideas from anyone and everyone. He was gregarious. He was charming. He always considered himself a player's man. And in the end, he got disappointed through the such things as team tennis when the players weren't always on his side. And that worried him.
As Chatrier commercialised his tournament, the infrastructure proved increasingly inadequate. He modernised the centre court in the 1970s and then oversaw a much greater development that culminated in a state-of-the-art tennis stadium opening in May 2001, which was renamed the Philippe Chatrier Court. Chatrier had died 11 months earlier at the age of just 72. So what does Richard Evans think Chatrier would have made of having the centre court at Roland Garros named after him?
It's a good question. Part of him would have been embarrassed and the other half would have been very proud and very pleased that people recognised him. There was a suggestion just recently that because of his incredible record here, which will never be approached, Rafa Nadal, with his 14 titles, should have this stadium renamed. Well, I disagree, because Rafa reigned here as a king on court, but Philippe Chatrier recreated this place. We would not be sitting in this stadium as it is today without Philippe Chatrier's work and vision. Not every Grand Slam has had one man have such a major effect on the growth and development of a stadium as this one by Philippe Chatrier.
And yet, the new court Philippe Chatrier wasn't state-of-the-art for long. 8 years after it opened, the French Tennis Federation announced it was seeking designs for an updated stadium with floodlights and retractable roof. There was a long political battle that included the threat of the tournament leaving Paris, as the Roland Garros site was by far the smallest in area of the four majors. But it eventually stayed, tradition this time winning out, and in May 2019, the new court was opened, still bearing Chatrier's name, and almost an exact copy of the court it succeeded, but with the important difference that play could be guaranteed. And that meant all four majors each had at least one stadium with a retractable roof. Wimbledon followed a similar pattern to Roland Garros, choosing to stay where it was and modernise rather than seek a new venue, although two alternative locations were considered. Wimbledon's revolutionary was John Curry, an electronics entrepreneur who became chairman of the All England Lawn Tennis Club in 1990. Even though Wimbledon was very much a jewel in the global sporting crown, Curry recognised that it couldn't afford to stand still. One of the people he brought onto the All England Club committee to deliver new dynamism was Tim Phillips, who was to succeed Curry as chairman 10 years later. What does Phillips remember about joining the Wimbledon committee in 1990?
There was a feeling that we needed to upgrade the facilities with rising expectations, people going to major sporting events. The centre court was getting tired. It was built in 1922. It needed improving. And John Curry, when he became chairman, set up this long-term plan group, which had, you know, an architect of property developer and some of us on it. We have done incremental improvements, material, but incremental improvements most years ever since.
The biggest outward sign of Wimbledon's long-term development plan was the building of a new Court 1 in the mid-1990s, with a memorable capacity of 12,345 seats. A few years later, there was a new Court 2, a new player services building, and a new layout of the Wimbledon estate, including a sloping, grassed area which has had several nicknames but is officially called simply The Hill, on which ground pass holders can sit with their picnics and watch matches on a big screen. Tim Phillips says the new Court 1 was needed to solve a logistical problem.
There was an issue. There's a health and safety issue because if old Court 1 finished a match at the same time as old centre court, there was overcrowding in the gangways. And old Court 1 was not it basically had a stand on three sides rather than four sides, as you will remember. It wasn't very well positioned. And so when there was the opportunity to build a brand new stadium, Court One, it was clearly a sensible idea.
It was an impractical court, the old Court One, but it was very quirky. Did you have some opposition in the sense of you can't get rid of that beautiful court tagged onto the side of the centre where you hear the applause from centre bleeding through to Court One?
Not really that I recall. I mean, there's always going to be somebody who misses some aspect. And we're always very mindful of the neighbours and how it affects them and so on. But in the end, everything went through pretty smoothly.
There was also the change of layout in the sense that you built the hill, a departure for Wimbledon, because there was no possibility to watch tennis on a screen within the grounds. Was that a very conscious decision, or was this just an extra feature which caught on massively?
No, it was a conscious decision. And when the foundations were being dug for Court One, which were material, that is where the soil that was removed was put, and so it got shaped to create this viewing area.
There were other modernisations behind the scenes. In 1993, Wimbledon bought the golf course across the road from its main site, which is likely to be developed into tennis courts in coming years. That same year, John Currie's efforts to make Wimbledon more businesslike meant he loosened the hold the British tennis authorities had on Wimbledon as a tournament. But the biggest modernisation was the transformation of the iconic centre court, complete with a retractable roof over the grass, a project motivated in part by Wimbledon observing what had happened to Britain's top soccer stadium, Wembley. Phillips was the club's chairman who oversaw the centre court project that culminated in the roof being used for the first time in 2009.
The two issues. One was centre court needed upgrading, the reinforcing of the terracing needed replacing, and in the end the east stand was completely knocked down and rebuilt, and on the other three sides the terracing was knocked in and just the terracing was rebuilt. So it was quite a material job in terms of redoing the centre court, the old original centre court. And the question of the roof became one of, in this day and age, when a man was put on the moon 50 years previous, how come at Wimbledon, which aspires to be the finest tournament in the world, that you can't play if it's raining? And if you couch it in that rather than in spreadsheet terms, you say, well, that's barking mad. And so then you get into the question of, well, how do you do it? And there are two aspects. One was physically building the structure, which was the easiest part. And the more material part is having built the structure and closed the roof and you've got 15,000 people all exhaling, how do you stop the grass from sweating and becoming unplayable? And that is the clever part.
So much of centre court is about tradition. It's over 100 years old now. How big a challenge was it to marry up keeping the tradition with making it a modern state-of-the-art stadium?
Well, it was one of the important features. This is a sort of a trite phrase that I coined, which is tradition with innovation, which was trying to capture the two components of... You don't want Wimbledon to alter. You want Centre Court to have the same feel to it. But you have to keep up with people's expectations. Otherwise, you get what I call, possibly unfairly, Wembley syndrome, where Wembley said that it was the home of football for, you know, decades, and then found, in fact, it was decades. It had decayed and they had to knock it down and start all over again. Whereas by enhancing the facilities in the gradual way we've done it, firstly, we were able to play on centre court every year throughout the building process. And secondly, we brought all the facilities up to, you know, current expectations.
So was there a sense of relief that it worked, or were you, by the time it happened, were you confident that it was going to?
Well, we got good people. We expected it to work. I mean, we wouldn't have done it if we didn't expect it to work.
Wimbledon is still thought of as the most traditional of the four Grand Slam tournaments, yet today it's very much a state-of-the-art tennis venue, but still with the grass, still with the traditions, notably the all-white clothing rule, and still a private members' club. The US Open broke from its private members club venue in the mid-70s, leaving the Westside Tennis Club in Forest Hills in the New York district of Queens, east of the East River, and relocating a short distance away at Flushing Meadows. The moderniser-in-chief was an unlikely Southern State Conservative, W.E. Hester, known as SLU. Because the presidency of the US Tennis Association is only a two-year term, there isn't a lot an individual can do in the time. But SLU Hester had made his money in the embryonic oil industry in the Deep South, known as the Wildcat Oil Business, where he hired geologists and took gambles on where the best drilling deals were to be had.
It's a very chancy field, and I think the fact that I was in that type of a business was one reason that I was willing to recommend and move the U.S. Open Championships out of Westside into an unknown park, into a situation where, when we disagreed with Westside on a number of items, we had actually 18 months to move and find a place to play. And we got the park property 14 months ahead of the 1978 U.S. Open and built Flushing Meadows Stadium, which is 20,600 seats in the main stadium, 6,200 seats in the grandstand, 9 indoor courts. And we built the entire thing after 14 months after we secured a lease on the property.
Not long before he became USTA president, Hester had been in a plane taking off from New York's LaGuardia Airport when he looked out of the window and saw a mass expanse of semi-derelict land in Corona Park, part of the meadowlands south of the town of Flushing. It had been the site of the World Fair in 1964, and the Singer Bowl Stadium, that had featured a number of events, including a concert by the jazz legend Louis Armstrong, was still largely intact. At that time, the US Open seemed to have secured its future at Forest Hills, as the club had converted its tournament grass courts to the dark green North American clay, or basalt, in 1975 to answer complaints about the poor quality of the grass. But there were still disagreements between the club and the USTA. So within his two-year term as president, Hester masterminded the US Open's very rapid switch from private club to new National Tennis Center, as well as a third different playing surface in 5 years.
To me, Flushing Meadows is the ideal facility, and I won't say tennis facility. It's the outstanding facility in the world for holding a major championship. The 9 indoor courts were not built for indoor play, but for catering. We have something that Wimbledon or U.S. Open Golf or no other tournament in the world has. We can seat 5,000 people in air-conditioned comfort for a meal. And therefore, the catering at the U.S. Open Tennis Championships is three times what the catering is at Wimbledon. And
But you haven't got strawberries and cream.
We have strawberries and cream about 60% the price that they charge in Wimbledon. I'm not sure whether our clotted cream is as good as the clotted cream at Wimbledon, but our prices are very, very much cheaper. And our strawberries, I'm sure, are as well, are as good, because I've just eaten Wimbledon strawberries, and I know they don't touch our California or Florida strawberries.
SLU Hester speaking with Bud Lesser in 1981. Over the weekend, he was inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame. But talk of strawberries and cream distracts from Hester's principal motivation. He was uncomfortable with the mecca of American tennis being a private club with access only for privileged groups. So it was the creation of an accessible national tennis center that motivated this otherwise dyed-in-the-wool traditionalist.
Basically, my experience with the old private clubs and all was not good. It didn't hurt me because it made no difference to me. I played most of my tournaments were Southern and local, but the players who had genuine merit, who didn't have the friendship of the big Eastern clubs and all, who could never play on grass, who could never play in the clubs, was not my idea of how tennis should be played. It's not my idea of how spectators should be treated, that you would have to be a member of one of the clubs to go into the restrooms or the restaurants or the bars. And so I have, while I'm a traditionalist and very conservative by nature, I also feel that the average spectator and the average player is entitled to recognition and entitled to all the comforts that can be offered.
We get the best out of the game in this way.
Well, to give you an example and one of the parting shots, when I was president, when I became president of USTA, our budget was $800,000. When I left office, after 2 years, our budget was $8 million. And the difference is what we got principally from the U.S. Open by taking it out of Westside, by owning it all, and by attracting the public. And we do have the public.
47 years on, Hester's National Tennis Center bears the name of an on-court American legend, Billie Jean King. The main stadium is no longer the old Singer Bowl, though that continues as the Louis Armstrong Stadium. But the main court is now the Arthur Ashe Stadium, opened in 1997 as the biggest purpose-built tennis arena in the world. It still is, and since 2016, it's had a retractable roof. No doubt the circumstances were ripe for the US Open to move venues, but it took someone of Hester's can-do mentality to make it happen. And, as he freely admits, a bit of luck, too.
I fortunately happened to be the right man at the right time. And everybody says, well, you're very smart. Actually, I'm not. I'm a gambler by heart, and I gambled. But I was very stupid. I was the only person who thought that the stadium could be built in 10 months, and we did it.
And the USTA president's term is still 2 years. The remarkable thing about the four tournaments that make up the Grand Slam is that while they all in their different ways represent up-to-the-minute technology and architecture, you'd still recognize the tennis they host well over 100 years since they were all founded. It's a modern sport, but tradition still plays a remarkably powerful role.
Chris Bowers on the way the four majors have kept up with modern-day developments without throwing away all of their traditions. The full interview with Slew Hester is in the International Tennis Hall of Fame's archive. Stay tuned this month for more stories of tradition in tennis, including a deep dive into the Hall of Fame's upcoming collaboration with Google Arts and Culture. I'm looking forward to chatting with Amit Sood, the director of Google's Cultural Institute, and Hall of Famers on the traditions that make this sport so unique. For more in this series, as always, go to tennisfame.com/podcast and choose from a wide selection of interviews and discussions involving the great names of tennis. I'm President Patrick McEnroe. Thanks for listening to the Tennis Worthy Podcast, and be sure to join us again in just a couple of weeks.